This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
From Love Sexy, it's Prince. And this is Mick. You're listening to Trivial Thursdays on WRFL. Good morning to you. It's 20 after 7. How did that happen? let's see. I can't figure out. I still can't figure out what to say about Prince. We'll just continue processing that, really. I will say this. Love Sexy was in one of WRFL's original play boxes back when it came out in 1988. And many of us were thrilled to have a new Prince album, and also like, God, all the songs are 7 minutes long, which I think is kind of like a classic length for a Prince song, actually. So the dude had like nearly 40 studio albums, which doesn't seem right to me. So I read it somewhere. I should have counted it myself. Maybe 40 studio releases. I don't know. He had so much music. And let's just say also that let the beginning of the, I mean, the releases that are going to happen for the next, like the rest of our lives, and I'm in the studio with two other people who are a variety of ages younger than me, will continue until all of us are no longer on Earth, I would say, just about. so anyway, what a bummer, really. But you know, when these great musicians pass, and we've seen two of them between him and David Bowie, one thing I will say is that they leave us with an incredible, incredible legacy of music. So, you know, I have been sort of like wading my way through the Prince catalog, much of which I'm not that familiar with, honestly. So, you know, I look forward to really probably years of listening to Prince records much more closely, because in a lot of ways he was always to me kind of a singles artist, but the albums they're deep, man. They're totally deep. So I'm just going to Alyssum on the mic too, because you're a big Prince fan.
Hey there, I sure am.
Alyssum Pohl is here, and Nicole, my social media manager. We're all here. Hi, good morning.
Good morning,
ladies, disco ladies. Alyssum, I think you and I have shared a dance party or two, a Prince-centric dance party
I'm
or
sure.
two over
Definitely.
The years. Right?
Definitely.
So, and, you know, I've been going around asking people sometimes, randomly, kind of, like, whether or not Prince figured into your life in any way. Not as a person, necessarily, but musically. And, I mean, the answer is almost always yes.
It's my go-to when I'm like, all right, I got to exercise and dance, and like, I'm not motivated, but I want to do it. That's my go-to. Just
right?
Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. I know. I'm looking forward to a Prince dance party at Mecca Dance Studio tonight, which will solve the dual problems of physical motion in honor of someone who has passed and aerobic exercise for Mick at the same time. What about you, Nicole? Do you have any like early memories of Prince or anything like that?
No, not really. Yeah. I mean, I never really got into Prince as far as like I go through my phases of totally like obsessing over a certain artist or anything, but it's not to say he was never there, never present as far as musically. Actually, I was just watching New Girl the other day, and it was, I think, the day before he passed, and he was on there. He made a little
cameo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it was actually a solid, like, half of it was he was in it.
The Zooey Deschanel show?
Yeah.
And Prince is on it?
Yeah. I think it's like the second season.
I sound like, oh, my God. But because that's a funny show.
No, it is. And I think it was maybe last week or the week before, didn't we have a trivia fact about him? That he was going to remake every album?
Oh, you know what? I think that's right. That was probably, I mean, that's kind of one of the fun things about Prince was he was, I mean, you know, two of the sort of most iconic and sort of idiosyncratic artists in popular music, David Bowie and Prince, you know, died this year. But Prince could outshine almost anybody for sort of eccentricity and sort of peculiarness. So, yeah, we did have that strange bit of trivia where at some point he had proclaimed that he was going to remake all of his albums.
And it was such a Prince, like, thing.
Yeah.
When we said it, we were like, that's very Prince-like. Yeah. I feel like he should have, like, his own vocab word, like, or adjective in the dictionary.
But it's unpronounceable. It's unpronounceable, and it's a symbol. I watched part of this Larry King interview that you can find. Like, suddenly, I mean, the guy was like, he had this incredible sort of psychotic control over his catalog. And so his records wouldn't be like they wouldn't be on YouTube. They wouldn't be on Apple Music. They wouldn't be on Spotify. They wouldn't, not that I would personally know, be really very available on like file sharing sites like BitTorrent. Like, I mean, it seemed like he had this army of people out there like removing his stuff from the internet all the time. But now things are starting to pour back on, like video performances and that kind of thing. Yeah. And there's a great, like, it's an hour long interview from like 1999, I guess, with Larry King. And I think it's always interesting to see him sit still and talk, because it sort of it both demystifies him and remystifies him. No, I mean, it's cool because it makes him human.
Yeah.
You know, and meaningful stuff comes out of his mouth the entire time.
Yeah. I saw him in Baltimore more this past year, and he was just so giving and caring, and it was incredible how he was actually able to not just perform for a huge stadium, but like really connect to the people of Baltimore in a meaningful way. There had been some riots and a police killing, and he invited the parents of the boy who had been killed onto the stage to watch the show from a couch on the stage, which was just so touching.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And I was reminded that I saw him like two or three times. And it was always, I just want to give full credit to some of my favorite best friends, people like Lori Houlihan and Teresa Toom, and I went to see Prince because they were like, Prince is coming and we've got to go. And that was where I kind of started out with Prince in a lot of ways, was like, Prince was never really my favorite artist, but he was the favorite artist of some of my favorite people in my life.
Yeah.
And so it was never like, oh, sure, okay, I'll go see. I mean, it was kind of like that, but it never wound up like that because he was incredible. He was just incredible. So like, you know, so I always just, the thing that I've been thinking about more than anything was that, you know, I came to Prince, maybe like some other guys, I came to Prince because of some of my female friends, but also discovered along the way, and this is something I've been thinking about mostly, that Prince, in the most sort of, in the way that's kind of hard to explain, and I'm still kind of looking for the right words, is an amazing male role model.
Absolutely.
And in some ways, his place as a male role model is just as important as anything else, really. He sort of helped, I think he has the power to help a lot of dudes be less macho or something like that.
Yeah.
Or you know, in the best way possible, I guess.
Yeah. He like broke out of that box that society, you know, kind of puts males in, honestly, and kind of his footprint and stamp on music. I mean, that's like obviously
so
undeniable.
And that is, you know, that's we went to see. I went to see Purple Rain. Purple Rain was at the Kentucky. Thanks to Fred Mills and Jeff and the whole crew there for showing Purple Rain on Monday. It was a pretty packed house, and it was a great thing to have happen. Hopefully that'll come around some more, or maybe they'll just, you know, get Under the Cherry Moon, which I don't think I've ever seen. Anyway. Let's see. Why don't we play another Prince song? And then we're going to come back. By the way, this is Trivial Thursdays at 7:30 here. And thanks for tuning in. Good morning to you. It's a little moist outside. I was coming in and I just want to... I've got a why question. And that is... It becomes sort of natural for people to not, I don't know, people sort of not like, don't like rain. When I was coming in, one of the guys sitting in the loading dock where you have to come through to get to RFL, there's usually a couple like UK physical plant workers sitting there. And, you know, and we have this conversation about how it's looks like it stopped raining, which is like a really common conversation to have with people. You're like, well, it looks like it stopped raining finally. And it just kind of set me thinking. I'm like, I don't know why it is. And I have a really simple theory about why it is, and that is that rain gets in your eyes. Because I started wearing a hat, and I like rain a lot more when I wear a hat.
I used to work with this guy, and like, no matter what the weather was, his job was to complain about it. He's like, oh, just trying to stay dry, or just trying to stay out of the sun, or just trying, like, no matter what it was like, he was never happy about the weather. It was pretty funny.
I think it's true. I don't know. It's a strange human condition. Or maybe animals bitch about the weather, but I don't think so. We're going to take another little musical break here, and... then we're going to come back and talk to Alyssa Pohl, who is going to tell us about... You've been in all kinds of weather, probably.
All kinds of weather.
On your adventure.
Speaking
of. So we're going to talk about an amazing
adventure. Some purple
rain.
No.
Let's see what we got here. Okay, I'm going to jump way back to Controversy, which is the first record that I remember hearing. Again, because of a girlfriend. In high school. So from Controversy, here's some Prince. This is Sexuality. We'll be back. This is Trivial Thursdays on WRFL. This is Mick. You're listening to Trivial Thursdays on WRFL. Thanks for tuning in. Let's see, what is it? Wow, somehow it's 22 until 8. I can never really do numbers in the morning, but I did a pretty good job just then. I am back in here with Alyssa Pohl. Alyssa, who I haven't seen in much too long.
Much too long. Probably a couple years.
Has it been that long? I feel like I guess, you know, is there a name? I don't know if there's a word yet for the condition of feeling like you've seen someone because you've just seen him on Facebook. Which, but I have seen your mom, and you have her laugh.
That's true. And her nose.
So my dear, you've been all over creation, and
I've stayed right here in the US of A, but yeah. I did paddle the length of the Mississippi River this past year.
Right.
And that
that's a thing.
It's a big part of the United States.
Right. Yeah, you've seen the United States on a kind of granular aqua level.
True. Yeah.
You've seen the United States at sea level, at river level.
At river level. I'll tell you one thing. If you ever want to reinvigorate your hope for humanity, go paddle the river. People were so nice and generous and helpful and always looking out for me. It was a good thing. It was pretty cool.
So that is, excuse me. I want to hear more about that, really, because like you said, you found people to be generous, helpful.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder if that's, so I had this experience far, far away in Vietnam. And there's a part of me that wonders if it's actually, if you look through the telescope kind of the other way, it's like maybe we're setting up too many situations where we actually just don't interact with people.
That's one thing. I think also just when people see others traveling and like you have an outsider, there's just sort of like most places, there's sort of like a culture of let's be hospitable to outsiders. Uh-huh. And especially if they're out there by themselves and kind of in situations that seem uncomfortable.
Right.
People really want to kind of help you to be more comfortable. And then also I was documenting plastic waste and water quality along the way. And of course, not everybody that I met along the way knew that to start off, but there were plenty of people who reached out to me and just said, hey, I live down in Leland, Mississippi. When you get down here, a couple who were actually alumni of the UK, they were like, we read your article or we read an article about you, and we know you're coming down this way. When you come down, please give us a call, and we'd love to host you and let you sleep in a bed and take a shower and eat some good meals. And mm-hmm. I took them up on that. It was amazing.
Did you find the buzz about your trip sort of growing as you went along? I mean, social media and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it continues, in fact. Like, I still get, I'm still getting calls to be speaking kind of around the country about what I did. And yeah, social media was really important for that. And I was kind of surprised at how much attention I was getting through old school media, just newspapers, which was kind of cool as well. I was invited to go speak at the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership up in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, at the university there earlier this month because of something that somebody read in the newspaper, which is pretty mm-hmm. cool.
Let's see. I'm going to back up some and just for our audience say that Alyssum Pohl is here in the studio. Alyssum, you are a, I was going to say, I don't know, an environmental scientist, but
sure.
Really?
Yeah.
Does that work? Okay.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah, and you've studied this for quite a few years. And you're also a, and I say this literally, not in the cultural sense, but also actually in all senses, a mover and shaker.
Ha ha ha. I'm a belly dancer. That's why it's funny.
And a dancer, period. I wasn't even going to, you know, there's belly dance. There's just, I mean, I always associate you with like sort of the kinetic.
Yeah. I can't just keep still.
And so when you're visiting here, you grew up here.
I grew up in Lexington. Yeah.
And you're currently, where do you currently call home?
I'm living in Washington, D.C. right now. Okay. With my two kitty cats.
Uh huh. And then are you doing environmental science-y sort of stuff there? Or what's the deal?
I'm trying to. I had a 2-year fellowship working on coastal resiliency issues from 2012 to 2014. And when that ended, I found myself looking for a job and applying for jobs and always being the first runner-up. And I decided that I was getting frustrated by that process of just being unemployed and not getting a job and feeling like, you know, I've spent all this time and energy educating myself on how to be a good environmental steward mm-hmm. and felt like, you know what, I don't have to ask for permission for this. I can just go and do the good work. So I created this project for myself, which was the paddling down the Mississippi and documenting plastic waste and water quality along the way. And it's been great. I mean,
did this start out as a joke?
It didn't start out as a joke.
Joke is probably too strong of a word, but like sort of laughing over drinks with somebody or something like that.
It was a dream that I had. Yeah. So okay. I woke up in one morning and was like, I had a dream that I was paddling with my two cats. And my friend looked at me and was just like, you're going to need a floppy hat. Yeah, she was basically like, I would totally pay to watch you try and paddle down a river with two cats. That's amazing. And then one of my other friends who has 14 cats of her own was like, oh, my God, they can't speak. But if they could, they would say, we don't want to go. So she was like, just drop them off at my house. It'll be like summer camp. I've got 14. What's two more? So they stayed there for the summer, and I was able to do it cat-free, which turned out to be a good thing. But, yeah, so that's kind of how it started.
So... And then why the Mississippi?
So I realized that I needed a big infusion of outdoors. My background, my master's degree is in international environmental policy. So obviously going internationally would have been preferable. However, I didn't have any money because I had just finished my fellowship, which didn't pay well either. So I needed to be somewhere cheap, which meant that it had to be in the States. And my dad lives up in Cincinnati, and every time I go to visit him, we go down to the river, and we always just kind of like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to go down the river sometime? And so it was sort of in the back of my head, like floating down the Mississippi. It's just like a Huck Finn kind of like thing that you think about and never really do. And I thought, why don't we do it? I'm going to go do it. So that's how it came up.
Let's see. So, and you did this. And again, the term floating, I think, is a little...
Yeah, you can't... People say that. That's like the, oh, you just Huck Finn and you just float down. No. You're working hard every day. Like, the river most of the time when I was paddling was only about a mile an hour, the current. And so you're paddling hard the whole time, for sure.
Did you, you must have gotten a sense of the, I don't know, kind of the, well, a variety of senses of the Mississippi. I was going to say the sort of magnificence of the Mississippi.
Yeah, yeah. I think I, so when I left, I sort of had, I had it in my head, okay, the very beginning is going to be exciting because it's new and different, and I'm just trying to figure out what, I didn't know how to kayak, so this was all brand new.
That was good. I'm glad you're getting to that because I was curious about that. This was all in a kayak, and yeah. I was curious about whether you had previous experience
no,
with kayaking.
None. I mean, I had like rented a kayak for like an hour, a couple afternoons or something with friends. But
kayaks are those boats you sit down by yourself real low in that,
that's right.
that flip over the instant you sit in
that's
them,
right. Yeah, so I took one lesson in how to right myself if I should flip over. Luckily, I never had to use that. I never flipped over. But yeah, so I it was all new. So I thought, okay, so the beginning is going to be all new and different, and I'm going to be riding the wave of just kind of excitement and thrill. Mm-hmm. And then I knew that at the very end, I was going to be really excited to be getting back to comforts and home and stuff like that, but I couldn't really imagine the middle. And the
right.
Mississippi is long, and everything I ever heard about it was like, oh, it's so industrial and there's so many barges and it's just, you know, it's not really a very pretty river, blah blah blah. People were totally wrong. I mean, yes, there's barges, but it was beautiful the entire way and it was never boring. And I realized that you get good at it, like, and at the point at which you get good at it, like the middle of the river, suddenly you want to get up and go and do something that you're good at, and you really enjoy it. And the sky was my favorite part of the river. Just being out under the sky and watching the changing sky every day was incredible. It was amazing. And if you want to come and see some of those pictures of the sky tonight at the public library, I will be giving a free talk about lessons that I learned on the Mississippi. In room 100A.
At the
downtown
yeah,
public
the downtown library.
Yeah.
Alyssum Pohl is here, and we're talking about Alyssum's journey down the Mississippi River in a kayak, which went on. How does a river start and end is a good question.
Yeah,
for me.
That's a great story. Great question. Oh, and just to, so I don't forget, it starts at 7 o'clock and goes to 8 o'clock tonight, the talk that I'm giving. It starts as a little trickle. It's like, it starts at Lake Itasca, Minnesota, and it's just a little stream, and it's often not deep enough to actually float, so you end up just like pulling your kayak across rocks and beaver dams and just hoping that it floats soon. And then it ends. So I finished.
So wait, back up to the
yeah,
start, because
sorry.
I'm always... So like, you don't have to know this kind of thing, but like, I don't understand where it comes from. Where does the Mississippi River come from?
Yeah, no, I mean, so
like, it doesn't come up out of the ground or anything.
Yeah, it does.
Does
yeah,
it? Okay.
Yeah, it comes up out of the ground.
They call those the headwaters. I think.
That's right. Exactly. It's the headwaters. So it creates Lake Itasca, and so okay. I mean, you don't really actually see where it's burbling up because
right.
you just see a lake.
Okay.
But then you see an exit of the lake, and that's where it's officially no longer Lake Itasca and now is the Mississippi River.
Okay.
And it's this tiny little thing that's probably about 10 feet across, but like gravelly, and you can walk across it on stones without getting your feet wet. That's
wow.
how little it is.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is, I mean, and with a kayak, actually, despite my pretension otherwise, I actually have been in a kayak a few times. And so, I mean, it sits in the water, not like 3 inches or
yeah,
something
exactly.
like that. So,
exactly.
I mean, so we're talking shallow.
It's super
here.
Shallow. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't cover your ankles
okay.
when you start. Yeah. And then it kind of like the first day or two, you're kind of alternating between the boat not floating and you have to drag it across the gravel and sand, and then like all of a sudden being 10 feet. And then it's, you know, so you have to hop in really quick so that you don't like, you know, wade through 10 feet of water, but then you have to hop back out so you can drag it over gravel again.
Which is called, is that called?
It's not portaging yet. You're just dragging it. Okay. Yeah, portaging it is when you have to like undo all your bags and like take it out of the water and drag it around something. So, mm-hmm. yeah. Like, and you do that for all of the dams that are in the beginning of the river.
I'm sorry, we can't say dam on the radio. So let's talk a little bit about you mentioned your bags and stuff. I mean, yeah. how much stuff do you take on something like this, and how do you do it? Giant Ziploc bags?
Dry bags, yes, okay. Basically. And a lot of Ziploc bags, absolutely. I had a huge dry bag that had all my electronics because I knew I was going to be blogging along the way. Mm-hmm. I had a bag full of food. I had about a month's worth of dry goods at a time. I had my camping equipment, so my tent and my sleeping bag, my sleeping pad. And then I didn't really have very many clothes. What else did I have? I don't know, just little bits and bobs other than that, water and stuff like that.
So would you... you weren't, when you would decide to kind of like pull up on the shore for the night or whatever, mm-hmm. I mean, like, were you camping just beside the Mississippi?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The first 400 miles, Minnesota has a really awesome, they call it a water trail. And so the Mississippi is something that they encourage people to go and explore. And
oh, okay.
So they have water access only campsites, which is great.
That's because, really neat.
Yeah. Yeah, it is really neat. Because for one thing, it gives you a place to get out and camp, because otherwise it's just completely marsh and there is no place to camp. Like, you can see land far away from you, but basically you're just in marsh for hundreds of miles. And so these river access campsites are like a small beacon of dry land that you can pull out of and camp, which is great. But also at the beginning, you don't know what you're doing, and it provides like the ability to kind of look at the map and say, okay, the next campsite is 15 miles. I guess I'm going 15 miles today. And when you're kind of getting your feet wet, so to speak, and figuring out what you're doing, that's really helpful. After those first 400 miles or so, you don't have campsites designated anymore, and you're just kind of on your own. So there's little islands, which are a great option. They're, you know, as far as doing this alone, being on islands is a great way to kind of stay away from potentially nefarious humans, mm-hmm. which is probably your biggest danger, although everyone was nice to me.
Well, yeah, and this is something I wonder about. There's a lot of times these days when, and maybe always, but definitely these days, whenever you do something that everybody else isn't doing, I wonder how many people, like, intensely cautioned you. They're like, you should be really careful.
Oh, yeah. My parents were super freaked out, and a lot of people were like, are you carrying a gun and blah, blah, blah. I was like, no. I actually talked to a woman who I took a personal safety course from, and she was a Marine, and she teaches self what's it called when you like learn how to defend yourself, self-defense, derp. Yeah. And so she was like, no, don't take a gun. For one thing, you'll be passing over 10 state lines, so that could be potentially illegal. But also, you're going to put yourself in more trouble if you have a gun than if you don't. So just carry pepper
spray. The chances of using a gun are, as I understand it, infinitely more likely if you have one than if you don't.
Right. Exactly.
Alyssum Bowl is here, and this is Trivial Thursdays. We're talking about Alyssum's epic trip down the Mississippi River in a canoe.
A kayak.
the second woman to do this.
Second woman to do it solo.
There
are other women who do it, but usually with a group of other people.
Fantastic. I want to hear so much more. Let's take a slight musical break here just for a moment. This is Make It Trivial Thursdays. Thanks for tuning in. If it's your birthday, happy birthday to you. You share your birthday with, let's see who, Lady Gaga. Today's Lady Gaga's birthday. I say that like I'm super excited. I don't really know that much about Lady Gaga. let's see. So anyway, congratulations on that. What else? Who else's birthday? It's Vince Vaughn's birthday, the writer, actor, and producer, and
Reba McEntire.
Reba.
Yeah.
Reba's birthday. Dave Kooning from The Killers. Darth Vader. No, David Vadim.
Here's a question for you. It's also Melchior Ndadaye's birthday. Do you know who that is?
No. Is he a soccer player?
No.
That's my best bet.
He is a Burundian banker and politician and was actually the fourth president of Burundi.
Ooh, how about that? If you reach back, you know, you find people who are celebrated for in ways that I'm sometimes happy to hear. You know, people like I'll see, you know, mathematicians celebrated and that kind of thing. So in this case, in 1962, also the warlord was born.
Oh,
he was an American wrestler.
Speaking of wrestlers, it was also Kitana Fuji Katsuaki's birthday, who was a Japanese sumo wrestler. And the 52nd Yokozuna, which I don't know what Yokozuna means, but I assume it's something specific to sumo wrestling.
Oh, yeah?
I'm assuming.
I'll assumo with you.
Oh!
Alyssa Bowl is here. And tonight, Alyssa is going to be giving a talk.
Yes.
Call it a talk, I guess.
Yeah.
At the Lexington Public Library. It's at 7, right?
7 to 8 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Open to the public.
Yep. And, room 100.
And Alyssa is back from an epic journey the entire length of the Mississippi River in a kayak.
Incredible. One paddle at a time.
There's a joke there somewhere, but I don't know. That's just the joke. That is the joke. How about that? Let's see. So we talked about the beginning of the river. We were going to talk about the end of the river. And then the most mysterious part, I think what you were saying before, the middle of the river.
Yeah. We got as far as the middle, but the end is actually kind of interesting. So back in the 20s and 30s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers re-engineered the river to, they rerouted it to go past Baton Rouge and New Orleans. So the way that the river flows right now is not the way that the river wants to flow. It's heavily engineered to do that because it kind of goes, it's been going winding south and then all of a sudden it hits Baton Rouge and it goes and starts going east. Because the U.S. Army Corps decided that's where it needed to go. So I decided when I got to that point that I wanted to go the way that the river wants to go. And so there's this little, what they call the old river, which is the Atchafalaya. And so I went down the Atchafalaya, which is a really amazing way to experience bayou culture. And kind of meet some really interesting characters and see some amazing wildlife while you're down there too.
Mm-hmm. So this is through this is in Louisiana.
This is in Louisiana.
And the people and sort of I don't know, I guess homesteads that you, because this is a kind of really mysterious lifestyle to a lot of people, I think.
Yeah.
There was sort of, I'm not going to say in any kind of, you know, comprehensive way, but documented dramatically in Beasts of the Southern Wild a little bit, maybe. I don't know. Would you say or not? I mean, I know that was New Orleans, but
yeah,
people that live like sort of provincially, like way out in the swamps.
Yeah.
Of.
I mean, there's a huge one thing that it was really interesting and not something that I necessarily expected was that the culture of people up in Minnesota and Wisconsin was very similar to the people in Louisiana, which I never would have expected. And what I mean by that is that all three states have a population of people who are fiercely outdoorsy, really love to share that with outsiders, visitors from other states,
mm-hmm.
and are very, very proud of what they've got and showing you how they spend their time outdoors. Lots of hunting, lots of fishing, lots of just going and camping and enjoying life outdoors, which is really cool. So that was one thing that I didn't expect. And then another thing is that, you know, up north, you've got people who are, they luckily have a strong history of like Leo, of what's it called? What's his name? Aldo Leopold and other environmental people. So they are, you know, they've got a good history of environmentalism and conservation going mm-hmm. on. But down in Louisiana, they don't have that necessarily. And mm-hmm. they also have all of the pollution that's come down the river from all the other states. So it's, you know, a lot of people up north have a lot of hope and a lot of practice in conservation, whereas down south they have this pride, but they don't have the hope. And that's really sad.
Okay. And I'm glad you brought it back to this because one of the core values of this trip you made wasn't net really tourism per se. I don't know how many tourists would actually do that. But the conservation issues, environmental mm-hmm. issues, and those sorts of things.
Right. Yeah. When I mentioned to people that I was documenting plastic waste and water quality along the way, people in those three states at the top and the bottom of the river were very supportive and very encouraging and really hoping that my work would help their, you know, the way that they live. Whereas people in Iowa and Illinois and, you know, the middle states, they would kind of give me a side eye when I told them what I was doing. Like they thought that I was maybe going to narc on them or something. Like they would get in trouble. They know that, you know, that especially Iowa and Illinois, they are the two most polluting states due to runoff from agriculture. So they know that and are unfortunately just sort of like, I don't know, they kind of run around with a feeling of guilt. mm-hmm. So that was interesting too, just to see that.
Did you encounter I just can only imagine the range of people that you must have encountered on this trip.
Yeah. Old, young, rich, poor, dirty, clean, you name it, and all of them were helpful, which was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely was an exercise in blowing away my own stereotypes. And or in some cases supporting stereotypes, but broadening what I expected from those stereotypes. Mm-hmm. people were cool no matter what their background.
What do you? You must have. Let's see. So, what are some? Did you have any just kind of unforgettable moments?
Absolutely.
On the trip.
So one story that I'm not talking about at the talk tonight, so I don't give away all of that, is so about halfway through the river, I met another woman who ended up being the third woman to solo. Her name is Leanne. And she and I ended up enjoying...
She was slower than you.
She started 5 days after me, and then she caught up, so she's actually stronger than me. Yeah.
Okay.
But she let me finish 5 minutes ahead of her. She was like, you can paddle out before me so that you still are the second. Anyway... we really enjoyed each other's company and ended up finishing the river together. And she and I, we got caught in just south of, where were we? Just south of somewhere in Mississippi. I'm totally blanking out right now. But anyway, we got caught in Storm Patricia. And so we ended up having to get rescued off the river by someone who lived upstream and offered to come and help us if we needed it. And we did. So we spent a couple days at his house just kind of waiting for the storm to pass. And so we were already a couple days behind schedule. And at this point, we were already planning which day we were going to hit the Gulf of Mexico. And so we had a party with friends and family that were meeting us at the end. So we kind of had a date where we actually had to stay on schedule, which scheduling things when you're doing something like this is always a bad idea for that reason. But anyway, so we were kind of in a hurry. And then the day that we were getting back on the river, we were in a hurry, but we didn't get out onto the river until like 2 or 3 o'clock. And so as soon as we get in the water, I go out and I start collecting my data because, you know, every hour I was collecting data. So I'm collecting my data and there's just like commotion over on the bank. And there's just like this towboat and some fishing boats and just commotion. We're like, what are they doing? And it looks like a mess. I don't know. And then we hear man overboard. And I was like, oh, no. So I sent Leanne over. I was like, I got to finish collecting my data, but I'll come over as soon as I can. And then right there, my rudder broke. Like, my rudder just completely stopped working. And because of all of the storm, the water was just like rushing past and super strong. So the water's going crazy. There's like trees, like entire logs, like entire trees rushing down the river too. So all
these
I could
are,
do.
These are somewhat hazardous.
These can, are somewhat hazardous. Yeah. You don't want to get hit by a tree. And I could only paddle to steer myself. So that sucked. So, and this person is like man overboard. So we're trying to get over there. I was like, I'll get over there as soon as I can. So we get over to this guy who's on a jet ski, and he's got two jet skis, one of which is upside down and half sunk. And the other one is just like not working. And he's freezing because he was the man overboard. What happened was he owns the towboat. The towboat engine isn't working. He's trying to pull the towboat with a jet ski to bank to the bank. Yeah. And it's not working. And so he's trying harder, and he manages to flip his jet ski. So that's when they yelled man overboard. He manages to get to the back of his towboat, get another jet ski to save the first jet ski. But then when he's saving the first jet ski, the second one gets tangled up in, like, there's like rope or something in the motor, and it just, everything stops. And so meanwhile, he's like going into hypothermic shock because he's freezing because it's really cold water. And he's like, oh my God, he's just like flailing with all these words about his boat and doing this and doing that. And then there's the two of us who have no engines and are just in kayaks, and we go over and we tie one boat to one jet ski and the other boat to the other jet ski, and we just paddle our butts off until we get to the bank. And
you're pulling jet skis with kayaks?
Exactly. Yeah.
Cap-sized jet skis.
Yes. And yeah, and he's
like
just,
you do.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, with trees washing by, you know, and no rudder to help. And so, like, Leanne and I are just, like, laughing hysterically at the ridiculousness of this. And this guy is just, like, not pleased and also, like, totally surprised and flabbergasted at this. And so he's still trying to, like, oh no, we got to do this, we got to do that. And I was like, once we got to the shore, I was like, look, Your ideas of what is the best thing to do got you into this situation, so you need to shut up. And his lips were turning blue. I was like, you need to take off your clothes. Here is a towel. Here's a jacket. You need to warm yourself up. Get all of the cold stuff off of you. Here is Gatorade. Here is food. At this point, his carotid is like just like pinging. He's totally in shock. And so once I just gave him direct orders, he sat down and he followed the orders, and he was a very good patient, and he was very patient also. And he just started muttering and saying over and over in a mantra, I can't believe I'm saved by two women in kayaks. I can't believe I was saved by two women in kayaks. Like, he was very respectful, but it was really hilarious.
I hope that you change that guy's life.
He was actually from Kentucky.
Is that right?
He is.
Coincidentally enough.
Yeah, he's like, of course I was saved from some Kentucky girl. Kentuckys are the best. I was like, yeah, well, some of us. No. He was great. He was really nice. And he was very grateful. Yeah, so we managed to turn over his sunken jet ski and de-water it and get it floating again, and then we got him all set up. But by the time we were finished, it was like 8 p.m. and it was getting dark, and we hadn't paddled at all. So we ended up paddling through the night that night to
really
make up for our lost time.
Now, what are the what hazards would be connected to nighttime paddling? Did you do much of that?
We ended up doing quite a bit of night paddling. For a few reasons. One is that the wind is usually against you and strongest during the day. And that's how we started paddling at night. It's just because, you know, you'd be paddling fervently all day long and only making like 8 or 10 miles and be exhausted. But if you waited until the wind died down, you could paddle at night and get a lot farther without as much energy loss. Mm-hmm. And then also, it's just freaking beautiful. And then you don't have to worry about all the recreational traffic, which is nice. You do have to worry about the barges still, but at night they have crazy floodlights that you can see from like 5 to 10 miles away.
My parents' place is near those on the Ohio.
Do you know exactly what I'm talking
about? Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah,
it's like something out of Close Encounters of the Third Kind or something. We're like, because the farmhouse that they have is a couple miles from the river, but if you sit out in the nighttime, a spotlight will like cut through all of reality, and you're like, whoa.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. It cuts through all of reality. Yeah. Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah, so there's no chance of missing the barges. And as we got more comfortable, we were kind of hoping that we would not be spotted by them, because once they spot you, they keep the floodlight on you so they don't miss you, which means that you're completely blinded. And so I'd be paddling at night with my sunglasses on.
Right. Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, they're easy to avoid as long as you can see where they are. And when you're being blinded, it's sort of like a guess. You kind of go over to the side and hope that they pass you by. Kind of annoying, actually. So a few times we were able to skirt outside of their vision, and we're like, yes, we went unnoticed and tricked them that time.
Stealth kayak.
Yeah.
Alyssum Pohl is here, and Alyssum, it's been great to visit with you.
Likewise.
I really want to come tonight and hear more stories of your odyssey down the Mississippi River.
Yeah, so we've got 6 to 7 at Mecca Prince and 7 to 8 at the library.
Yes.
Paddle down the river of the Mississippi.
Yeah, yeah. let's see, what would you, any words to anyone that's considering a personal odyssey of those proportions?
Absolutely. So I think that not everybody's dream is to paddle the Mississippi. Maybe you don't swim, maybe you don't like water, maybe whatever. But do whatever you have a dream of doing, because no one's going to do it for you. And, you know, for me, this was a really great opportunity to make a crappy situation, aka being unemployed, and use that time to do something that was really meaningful for me. And actually has furthered my resume more than I even expected. So that's kind of cool, too.
Now, people, if they... you created a Facebook group.
I did. Yeah. If you go on Facebook and search Paddle On, you should be able to find it. And then, so I post all kinds of plastic waste and other paddling articles there, and keep people updated to other things that I'm doing related to the trip. Mm-hmm. And through that, you can also, if you scroll down farther enough, you'll be able to find my blog, which is on Weebly. And you should be able to find that if you just search my name, Alyssum.
We'll post it on the Trivial Thursdays page, too.
Awesome.
So people can keep up with that.
Cool.
Alyssum, I can't wait for us to visit again and to find out what next adventure you have.
Thanks.
In your,
you too,
adventurous kinetic life.
Thanks for having me.
Alyssum Pohl, who is speaking tonight at 7 at the public library about her trip down the Mississippi River. This is Trivial Thursdays. We're going to take a brief break and check in with news from the University of Kentucky Journalism Department, and be back with Lexington architect and jazz musician Byron Romanowitz.
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at WRFL.FM, and of course via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to WRFL.FM/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.
There must have been so much music that happened there.
Oh, yeah.
And now it's really actually gone, right?
It's gone completely. it was a real, it was the best jazz venue that Lexington's ever had.
Well, it was also my favorite, like, bar as a disciple and fan of, and then by bar, I don't mean the entire establishment. I mean the actual bar.
Oh, certainly.
Because the bartenders would stand down at like a lower level to where you were on eye level with them.
Right.
Which is really old school. You don't see that much anymore.
No, you don't.
And it was dark in
and
there.
The food was good, too.
Yeah. Now, Byron, you've been on the show, I think, a couple times. Maybe just once. I don't know.
Once. Just once, okay. Mike. That's all.
I am I'm very happy to have you back. And one of the first things I want to mention is in your storied history as an architect and a jazz musician in Lexington, we happen to be sitting in one of the buildings that you are, what would you call it?
Well, I designed it. I was the architect.
Thank you. I didn't want to overstate the case, but I don't mind for you to.
No, that's true.
Now, I'd like to, on behalf of the entire WRFL staff, I'd like to apologize for our decorating job in here.
Well, I love your decorating job. It's done. It's a live thing. Every time you turn around, there's bound to be something else that's fun to look at.
The RFL Studios, and for those listening, is absolutely festooned, I believe is the word, with graffiti and whatnot. And we are in the basement of the Whitehall Classroom Building.
Correct.
Which is upon which my guest Byron Romanowitz would have been the architect of note.
That along with the Patterson Tower, they were the same project. We put the two of them together at the same time.
Right. And there's tunnels connecting them and things like that, I think.
Yes, yeah. That's right. We didn't put a bridge connecting them because that would have ruined the elevator operation, because people would have stopped to the second floor, gone across, and the ones down in the front, down on the ground level, are waiting. The elevator company said, don't do that. Don't
okay.
Make a tunnel. So we did.
Huh. So they thought that it was just from a people flow standpoint, it would mess everything up?
People, yes. The people would make a choice, and then it would just mess up the operation of the elevators. The interesting thing about the elevator faculty tower is that the faculty, we had a long time trying to educate them, because they thought that because they were 50 yards from where they were going to teach, that they could wait till 2 seconds before the class started and go down. So the elevators got terribly crowded. Finally, they realized that they may be 50 yards from their classroom, but they are at least 5 to 10 minutes from their classroom by the elevator operation. You couldn't put enough elevators in that tower to get people to meet their expectations.
Now, these are the things that architects think about.
Well, yes,
some of them.
We do.
Yeah.
We do. Uh-huh. You hope the architect thinks about them.
Byron Romanowitz, who have played a multifaceted role in the landscape, the architectural landscape of Lexington.
Yeah.
Here on the University of Kentucky's campus, downtown as well.
Yeah, we did a lot of buildings around here, 13 college and university campuses throughout Kentucky. We did from the time the firm was founded until I retired, we did well over $1 billion worth of construction, and that was unadjusted for inflation. You can imagine what that would be now.
Hmm. Wow.
$10 square foot building then is about $150 now, maybe. So you can imagine what a dollar volume of construction that would be.
Yeah. And I noticed not too long ago, I was visiting the studios of what I'll call our cousin station, WLXL, which
yes.
is the new community radio station that's in that's housed in what they call the Steam Academy.
Oh yeah,
which
yeah.
is the grade school, former grade school, I think, on 6th Street.
Yeah,
And there's a plaque out front, and you were listed as the principal architect there, not of the school, but of a renovation that was done.
I guess we did. There's so many we did, I can't remember. I'd have to go back and look at the records. But did they spell my name right?
As best I could tell.
That's my problem.
Right, right.
I answered, you know, I answered anything close.
Now, one of the things I liked about seeing your name over there was this is just a block away from, and this is where we're going to kind of switch gears. You have a couple very profound aspects of your life. One of them is your career as an architect, and then the other one has to do with your love, passion, and career, we'll call it, as a jazz musician.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Mick, but the University of Kentucky Libraries just a few months ago told me they wanted me to archive all of my writing and background material for architecture and for music. So I thought that was quite an honor. And
well deserved, I think.
Well, I'm just trying to get all my records together, but I have all kinds of background for two books that I've written. One of them is on architecture. It's called Issues and Images, mm-hmm. 50 Years as a Kentucky Architect. And the other one is Jazz in Lexington, A Personal View.
Yep.
And both of those have a lot of material that went into them. And the architecture book talks all about urban renewal downtown, mm-hmm. which I was on the Commission for Urban Renewal, and the city planning efforts. It goes way back in history. And then music goes back to the late 1800s, early 1900s here in Lexington. And it's quite interesting. But I got a copy of the jazz book for you that I put together that I'm going to hand to you tonight. Today.
You are a fine fellow, and I'm a proud owner of the jazz book. I think.
Oh, you are? Okay.
I think I have it.
Okay.
But you can swap me out for the architecture book.
All right.
No, but so let me for those who are out and about in town from time to time, who maybe you're downtown, who maybe go to Al's Bar.
yeah.
The corner of 6th and Limestone, I think, is a very, you know, it's funny. We can go by these in the same way that a lot of people go by buildings and maybe don't think much about them. Probably a lot of people go by sort of murals and art and maybe give it a glance and don't think much about it. But you are immortalized in a mural on the side of Al's Bar.
Yeah, I know.
That's you playing tenor saxophone. Right.
And with Duke
Madison.
Yeah.
Who was a fixture and an icon of the Lexington music scene, a jazz musician, tenor or alto or both?
Tenor.
Yeah,
tenor. And alto when he got older, mm-hmm. and the tenor was hard to hold up, he switched to alto.
Right.
And sat on a stool.
I'm happy to say that I came along in enough time to have seen Duke Madison a number of times.
Yeah. I started playing with him in 1949. We played together, performed together quite a bit. He'd play hot and I'd play cool. And so we did the black and the white thing, you know, and we played a lot of venues around town.
Well, to say, I'm going to jump right on that, and to say that you did the black and the white thing is something of an understatement, and certainly something that is worthy of a little bit more discussion. You were playing jazz music in Lexington at a time when segregation was pretty,
oh, absolutely.
Pretty much in full effect in
it
some
was.
Ways.
And if I guess some interesting stories about that. First of all, I started playing jazz in Lexington when I was 13 years old. I joined the Union when I was 14 because all the jazz players were way in the Army.
Interesting.
And they found high school kids or junior high kids who could play jazz and brought them in there. So I played in all these dives, you know, above Main Street, the VFW and places like that. And one of the places we played when I got to be a senior in high school was the VFW American Legion out on Georgetown Street. And that's where they got that picture of Duke and me.
Oh, okay, okay.
And then Duke and I...
Oh, you mean in the mural. It's based on
the mural.
Photograph.
Yes, okay. That's right. So... we had a lot of musicians were playing with the, as we call each other then, the colored folks,
mm-hmm.
and they played with us in venues, and so we got to be friendly with Duke, and so one of my friends who was living with another bachelor who was in UK said, "Hey Duke, why don't you come on over for dinner Sunday? Bring your wife and all that." And he says, "No," he says, "I can't do that." They said, "Why? Why not?" He says, "Our friends won't mind." And he says, "No, but mine will."
Okay.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And so, I mean, was that, talk about how you interpreted that remark from him.
Well, I just
was he being coy, what did he mean by that?
Well, there were people on both sides who didn't want us getting together, and we did anyway. Duke came over to my house many times for jam sessions. We didn't have any problem with that. But that remark was made to Harvey Berry and another friend of mine who were in the PhD program at UK. I did not hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Harvey and Glenn Roberts were living together, and they just wanted to invite Duke and his wife over
right.
for social evening. And evidently, it didn't work.
Well, so if I can ask you to talk about, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, race issues continue to sort of be one of, I think, our country's biggest challenges.
It's terrible.
So even while much progress has been made, I think a lot of people, younger people that live in the world today, probably have a hard time even fathoming how something like segregation could have been the case in Lexington, Kentucky in the 60s, are we saying here?
No, we're saying that in the 40s.
In the 40s, okay.
This was in the 40s and okay. very early 50s.
Right. And so what did that look like from a musical standpoint? That meant that...
We treated people as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And you either respected the individual as a good player and a good person, or you didn't.
Right.
And I can say that Duke was a great player and a very fine person.
Sure.
And as is his wife right now, too.
So what was the letter of the law or whatever? I mean, like, as far as white musicians and black musicians playing together, was it a legal problem? Was it?
No.
What was,
I don't think so.
But black players couldn't. What were the strictures on them in terms of?
Well, a lot of black players. There were a lot of black bands who played for white parties, and a lot of white, not a lot, but some white bands played for some black get-togethers.
Okay.
For instance, after we'd get through playing a job with the Bobby Blight Band in the 50s, we would go out to the Spiderweb on Georgetown Street and go down to the Subway Club, and some of the guys would get in the jam sessions down there.
Okay.
And that was perfectly acceptable. And our band, Bob Blight's band, was the first white band that played at the Lyric Theater in the 50s. A 17-piece big band, and we played there. But the funny thing, they requested that Bob not go as Bob Blight, but go as Bob Benson, because he just had the BB on the stands. But we thought that was silly as hell. But what, you know? But he did it.
What was the rationale? Or do you know?
I don't have. It was just some idiot.
Uh huh.
Some idiot who made rules and thought.
I'm sorry to the caller. Our staff. We're very thin staff today.
Okay.
And I can't. I can't. I wish that my full staff was on hand, but we're gonna do the best we can.
That doesn't bother me.
Let's see. So Byron Romanowitz is here, and Byron, who has played jazz in Lexington for decades and decades,
yeah,
and who was also who has worked as an architect for your entire professional life.
That's
too.
Right.
Yeah. Including the building that the WRFL is in here,
yeah.
which came up when we were talked about having you back on the show, and I was telling you that the studio had moved, and you said, "Well, that's my building."
Well, I can find my way through it.
I bet.
Yeah, we also did Singletary Center. I designed that and got a chance to play in it.
I think that old girl's holding up pretty well.
Oh, she is, or he is, I should say.
Yeah,
it is Singletary.
Right, I guess so.
Yeah,
that's one of my. I love that building. I worked as a stage manager there for a number of
years.
Did
you really?
But I still, you know, whenever I go there for shows and whatnot, I think the Singletary Center is a wonderful, wonderful building.
Well, it's held up pretty well.
Uh-huh.
What we tried to do there, we tried to make the exterior outside, you know, the part of the building that's not in the concert halls. We tried to make it as much as possible like the outside. Use brick inside in the walls, if you remember.
Yeah.
And so you don't have the contrast between outside and inside when you go into the building. The contrast occurs when you go from the areas around the concert halls into the halls, because then they're white, no brick whatsoever.
Right.
They're stark, and the shapes and forms are powerful.
Uh-huh.
So once you go into the concert hall, the drama begins.
Right. Okay.
See what I mean?
Yes, I do.
And then we tried to bring natural light in the interior with all the skylights. So again, it was like the outside.
Yes. Talking about the Singletary, the Otis Singletary Center here,
yeah.
Which was built in
19. It was.
I was going to say
70s.
79.
It was. I think 71.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I could look at. You can look it up in the architecture book.
Oh, right.
Exactly.
Yes.
And there are stories about all these buildings, inside stories about it, and some of them are funny as they can be. Some of them are frustrating.
I can't wait to read those stories. Byron Romanowitz. Who is here? But I want to take a quick moment and say, because I've gotten a couple phone calls and we're just sort of incapable of dealing with that. If you have a question for Byron Romanowitz, go to the Trivial Thursdays on WRFL Facebook page and post it there.
Okay.
And our social media manager Nicole will pass it on, and we'll see if we can get that question to Byron while we're on the air here. So
okay, do you want to hear another wild one from the Coach House?
Absolutely. The Coach House, which was a epic jazz club and restaurant,
club
on Broadway.
Get that one of Sweet Georgia Brown.
Okay.
No, it's not in there. It's right. In the other. Yeah. Sweet Georgia Brown, we used to advertise it when we'd announce it. You know, back in those days, there was a tune called Big Bad Leroy Brown. So
Jim Croce song.
Yeah, and uh-huh. We would always say, well, now, folks, we're going to play a tune that was written in the late 1920s called Sweet Georgia Brown. It was written about Big Bad Leroy Brown's swinging grandmother.
Okay.
I'll tell you about this.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do is cue this up in the background, and we'll listen to a little bit of it and come back with more from... We're going to take another quick break for the news. It looks like they're coming in here in a second.
Okay.
I'm going to play some Sweet Georgia Brown and then do some news and then come back a little bit more with Byron Romanowitz. So stick around. Like you said, this is recorded. This is at the Coach House.
Oh, yeah. This is a wild one. But it you got to listen to it a little bit before it gets really wild. But it'll start off all right. We're not hearing it in here, is that right, Mike?
I tell you what, I'm going to try it in the other CD player. This one's glitching out on us a little bit in the modern terminology. And so we'll be back. We're going to take a quick break here on Trivial Thursdays and be back with Byron Romanowitz and hopefully some Sweet Georgia Brown here from the Coach House and news from the University of Kentucky Journalism Department. So stick around.
We get more requests for this next tune than anyone we do. And this next tune than anyone we do. And this next tune than anyone we do. And this next tune than anyone we do.
I'm sorry, we're having some problems with that, Byron.
Okay, well.
That is, I love being here with you, which is true. My guest is Byron Romanowitz, and
yeah.
I do very much love being here with you. Thank you. Thanks for coming and visiting. What we were trying to play was a track from Jazzberry Jam.
No, that was Men of Note.
Oh, Men of Note. I'm sorry. Okay. And that was recorded at the Coach House.
No. No, let me tell you. One was recorded at the jazz concert given by the union down at the Campbell House.
Right.
Back in the 90s.
Okay.
And they just did, at the university just did a memorial concert to the Men of Note. About a few weeks ago.
Okay.
And because of the donations that we made of all our old book, to the University of Kentucky Library, and the UK Jazz Ensemble has access to all those arrangements.
Great.
And there are over 200 arrangements coming from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And all the bands here in Lexington from the 50s on, and some national bands too. So they invited those of us, some of us who are left of the Mennonite, to play with them. And we sat in with the Jazz Ensemble, and Miles did this whole thing as a tribute to all the archives that we have given to the library. And that's some of that musical archives that I'm donating.
Right. You're talking about Miles Oslin, the leader of the UK Jazz Ensemble.
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. So before we're running short on time, we've got some more time left, but I don't want to squander it. And I do want to mention that Byron Romanowitz, my guest, you're still playing jazz. You've got some gigs lined up for the summer with Jazzberry Jam, right?
Yeah, we do over at Acton Park.
Which has become kind of a tradition for you over there, right?
Absolutely. We played there from the beginning. I forget how many years it's been.
Uh-huh.
But Dan Brock and I have gone together. And Dan is with Jazzberry now, and as he was many, many years ago. And so he and I are playing together. We're going to do two concerts at Acton in July, I believe. I'm not sure when, but it'll be in the papers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Let's see. So, Byron, while we've got some time left, some other of your sort of favorite stories from your time playing jazz in Lexington, and then I'd also like to touch, if we can fit that in, along with some maybe observations about urban renewal and about some of the changes that we've seen downtown.
Well,
over the
let's
years.
Just go ahead with that.
Okay,
sure.
So you were saying you were on the commission for urban renewal.
I was on the urban renewal commission,
and
that's
which
exactly
kind of transformed downtown Lexington
in some
profound ways in the 70s.
Thank God.
Yeah.
In the 60s, really.
In the 60s, okay.
We lived with it in the 70s.
And you say thank God, because what was going on before that?
Oh, let me tell you, it was a mess. It was absolutely a mess. The railroad tracks had bisected downtown from the university, which, you know, it just was a big slash cutting right through. And the traffic was all screwed up. Smoke, noise, confusion. And urban renewal wiped that all out. Thank goodness for that. Urban renewal had Bill Qualls, who was the Lexington planner, who put down the one-way couplet downtown of the streets,
right,
in place of the railroad tracks, because people were seriously talking about running the interstates right through downtown, which would have absolutely divorced the university from the central city.
Mm-hmm.
It would have wiped out areas on the east side, the west side of town for interchanges. It would have totally destroyed Lexington, and some idiots were thinking about doing that. So we were able to stop it and transform downtown into what we tried to do was pedestrian-friendly space where traffic would be separated from people, and to, if anybody sees some pictures of the way the roads and the sidewalks and all were treated, we'll be happy to see that a lot of good things were done.
Mm-hmm.
Landscaping was done. The traffic, the utilities were put underground. So you didn't have that maze of black wires overhead.
Right.
And Lexington has picked up from that and is doing a good job at development.
Do you see downtown Lexington as being on the cusp of another big change, or do you think that it's ever sort of an ever gradual thing?
It's been, we had the urban renewal program, then we had a change in the 80s, late 80s. And I think we're going to be due for another one, but we got to get that hole filled up first.
Right. That is something to consider, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you think that the focus of development down in downtown Lexington, or maybe other places too, has shifted to more of a conservation standpoint?
Yes, I think so. They're beginning to consider something that we tried to put in 40 years ago, and that is infill construction.
Yeah.
to infill with compatible construction rather than wiping something out and replacing it.
Let's see. So let's turn. We've just got a few minutes left, and I don't know where the time always goes. But let's. So again, my guest Byron Romanowitz, who's been iconic in both the worlds of architecture and jazz in Lexington. Jazz in Lexington in the 40s, 50s, and 60s was particularly. It was a vibrant scene. Would you say
it really was?
And so much jazz was getting played for sort of dancing or...
Yes.
Yeah.
It was the pop... It was part of the popular music. And then, of course, other things came in. But
it also served as a way to bridge the gap between the races, between skin colors, right?
It certainly did. It certainly did.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to note that you need both races to produce jazz. There is no jazz in Africa.
Okay.
You need the big bang of a Western musical culture meeting the black culture from Africa, and those two went together and made something better than either one of them.
Yeah. Where the sum was greater than
the
parts.
They need each other. The black musicians and the white musicians absolutely need each other. They play off each other, like Duke and I did. He was hot, I was cool, and it worked.
So the stylistic playing you're talking about—the
right.
way that you all played.
That's
you,
right.
You both played tenor saxophone.
Oh, absolutely.
And but the sounds that you all that your lexicon of sounds were not the same necessarily.
It's not the same as Duke's, and we loved each other's playing, and we worked off of it.
That's fantastic. Let's see. So. Do you get to go out? Do you get out to see much jazz now? Do you get out to play jazz?
I go out to hear Joe Dojo every chance I get.
Right.
The last Monday of the month at the Comedy Club. That's the best band that it's ever been in Lexington.
Is that Miles and Vince?
Vince DiMartino, Miles Osmond's band, and everyone, and Ricky Cook and Jazz Trumpet in there, and just so many fine.
They're heavies.
Raleigh Daly, who used to be an icon in Jazzberry.
Yeah, those guys are
wonderful.
Heavies.
That's where I go for jazz.
Now, again, so, and they're going to be, they play every month, did you say?
The last Monday of every month, except in July, I think, when they take a break.
Okay.
Vince is sick right now. He didn't make the last one.
Okay.
And we hope he recovers.
Well, I hope he feels better. And Byron, I look forward to people getting to see you play jazz and hopefully have shared some of the background. I can't bear the fact that we have to go now, but Democracy Now! Is coming down the pike here. And so I want you to come back and visit again if
we'll
you will.
We'll do it again, yeah.
Okay. Byron Romanowitz, thanks again. And this has been Trivial Thursdays. Thanks to Alyssa Pohl for coming by. Have a great Thursday, and we will catch you next time here on WRFL Lexington.